Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelt quicker, pronounced Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water as well, all from one tap. Absolutely amazing. Thank you for sponsoring the show, Cooker. Today's podcast is another special.
Woo!
Today's guest is Rahul Jondial, and he is a brain surgeon. And I have to say, this is one of my favorite podcasts of all time. I read his book, and it's called Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon. And I thought to myself, as I explained right at the beginning of the podcast, like, why don't I know more about the brain? It is me, my brain, I assume. It's the bit where the consciousness is. So I should learn more about it. He is a neurosurgeon and a neuroscientist, and he basically knows everything about it. His truth and honesty about everything in it is fantastic as well. His knowledge is amazing. His passion, I mean, hopefully you can get it through the podcast, but he just lights up the room and his eyes are sparkling as he's discussing the brain, because that's what we all are. Thoroughly enjoyable, wasn't it, Mark?
Oh, man. It was great. I thought he was engaging, interesting, thoughtful, all the things that I really listen for a podcast. But also, little shout out to you there, Tim. Great questions.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's not hard to think of good questions, isn't it, when you're talking about the brain, because the brain is so interesting.
Yeah.
Right, well, listen, let's not mess about it anymore.
Just muck around for a little bit longer.
Let's meet him. This is Rahul.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Rahul, welcome to my kitchen. Thank you so much for joining me today. All my guests, I buy a present. I bought you some nice red wine, but I wasn't sure whether you drink.
I indulge.
You off duty. Okay.
So can I open it now? Or?
Well, you don't have to drink it now, but you can look at it if you want. But it's apparently a nice one. I have this guy who deals me out some nice wine. But if you're going back to America too quickly, you can gift it to someone. I'm not a problem with that. And while we're there, we might as well discuss alcohol and the brain, because let's get straight into it, because that's the one thing that majority of us do. How does alcohol affect the brain? Is it as bad for us as we probably think it is?
It's dose dependent, as many things are, and my perspective has always been to let people know what is the truth about their body and all the different things in life that can hurt or help. And usually it's a dual-edged sword. Medicine can help, medicine can hurt. We're allowed to purchase medicines at the pharmacy, and if we take too many of those pills, you can hurt yourself. We're allowed to purchase alcohol as well, and if you take too much, you can hurt yourself. But part of the mind diet, which was the only thing shown to stave off dementia, red wine is allowed in a glass or two. The American government allows it. So I think in small micro doses, it's perfectly fine and may even be healthy for your brain.
What's the mind diet? I know what it is. I've read your book, but yeah, you've just mentioned it, so we might as well talk about
it. It's an interesting acronym. It's Mediterranean Intervention for Neurodegenerative Delay, which is a fancy way of saying, eat this stuff and your brain won't wear out. Just like our knees can wear out, and you get arthritis and joint degeneration, which means wearing out, your brain is flesh. It too can wear out. And since we don't have a pill or a medicine or a shot for Alzheimer's or dementia, long longitudinal studies over decades found that eating a certain type of diet, which I think is actually quite tasty, can stave off dementia. And basically, it's essentially nuts, fruit, plants for sure, and fish and poultry if you're going to eat meat. Avoid red meat. Avoid fried food, avoid processed food. That all sounds great to me. If you do have a burger once in a while, as I do or as my kids do, that doesn't throw off all the gain you've had by being selective for most of your meals.
What's interesting though is the world's gone diet crazy. I mean, I know in America it's gone mad. Over here it is as well. So you've got the vegan diet, you've got the carnivore diet, you've got the keto diet, you've got intermittent fasting. There's lots of different things going on there. For us, it's a minefield. Which one is the healthiest? Do you have any opinions on any? You've just mentioned the mind diet, but what about things like intermittent fasting and keto and vegan?
I don't believe in fad diets. I don't think one eating one thing is going to fix all your problems. And if you're living a healthy life, I don't think having one indulgence is going to ruin your life.
Right.
What I do know is from personal experience, and if you don't mind, whenever I'm asked a question like that, I like to lead off with a story.
Yeah, go on.
And then people understand, well, why is this guy even talking about food? He's a neurosurgeon. I'm in Ukraine 6 to 8 years ago. We're climbing up the stairwell and I smell fat, sizzling fat in a hospital. We have known for decades that when you have aberrant brain signals, which is epilepsy or seizures, much like you have an arrhythmia of your heart, the beat is off, or the brain electricity can be off. If there aren't medicines or the medicines aren't working in kids, 100% fat intake, the product of that, the breakdown of that inside your body is medicine, will calm the electrical storm in your brain. Food is medicine. And Hippocrates said, let food be thy medicine. So that's my experience with food actually working as medicine. So then when I, you know, dove deep into which diets work or don't, the only thing proven is mind diet to stave off dementia. But that's, again, a glacial thing. You do it now so you're not in a risky bucket when you get older. And in the moment, if there is something, it's called intermittent fasting. And I don't think of it as a fad. It's not to lose weight. It's to rely on something that we are always exploiting, if you will, in the hospital, which is an all-fat diet for kids with epilepsy. And what it is your brain is a hybrid vehicle. It's not all electric, and it's not all gas. It wants to have glucose, which we have plenty of, but it also wants to have ketones. But you can't actually just eat ketones. You break down fat after 16 hours of not eating sugar or even food. And so what happens is you eat and you have glucose that goes to your brain. There are actually channels and ports that lets them into your brain cells. Not everything can get in. If you don't eat, you've got a backup glucose tank in your liver. It's called glycogen. It'll release glucose for you. You get to the 16th hour, it runs out. And then your body pulls fat and disintegrates it and releases ketones. Those two have that special permission to get into the brain. And at a molecular level, people have seen that that stuff, ketones and glucose, and metabolic switching back and forth between them a couple of times a week, seems to have the best effect on brain activity, cognition, and focus. That's not me saying, I found the fad diet. That's been there for 20 years. In the neuroscience literature, I'm just putting it forward in this book so people know exactly what we have proof
for. All right. Let's talk about the book. I've read the book. I love it. And it's such a bizarre book, actually, because you start reading it and you start thinking, why haven't I read more books on the brain? It's the most important thing in my body. Yeah, I've read so many books on so many different things, but actually how the brain works is fascinating. What made you write this book?
Well, I waited 10 years. In the States, we have instant experts. Everybody's got a brain. You're a mindfulness expert. You're a yoga expert. You're a achieve your better health expert in a second. I didn't want to be that guy. You've got medics who have never really practiced, and they're using books and television to get out of practicing. They never made it in our craft, and then they circumvented it and became experts and started disseminating knowledge. I just didn't want to do it that way. So for the last 10 years, I've been a professor at City of Hope Cancer Center. Before that, during my brain surgery training, I actually went on sabbatical, hung out with the kids, enjoyed the surf in Southern California, and got a PhD. So I had a unique perspective, a brain surgeon and a brain scientist, a brain biologist. And for the last decade, I'm seeing things come through on television, in magazines. This is where happiness lives in your brain. I was like, that's not how that works.
Yeah.
Your gut is your second brain. Actually, no. My partners have cut out a lot of intestines for cancer and bypass surgery. Those patients are just fine afterwards. You only use 20% of your brain. Actually, no. Every MRI I've ever looked at, there's lights going off on all different corners. But if I just came out too early and said that, I didn't really think that had the gravitas, if you will.
Right.
And then it becomes, well, why are you doing it? And I wanted to have stories, as we talked about Ukraine, as my entree into why I have an opinion and some information about food and the brain. Similarly, I wanted to have the gravitas and experience about 10 or 15 different pop science topics, creativity, sleep. These are all things I have personal experience with, surgical and scientific experience with, and then a cool story to open with. So every chapter opens with a couple of pages like, That's gnarly. That's interesting. That's riveting. And then it gets into digestible science. Like, look, there's reasons for the opinions I'm going to give. And then it debunks some myths that have somehow peppered our consciousness through pop media, but never really had the scientific backing for them. Mm. And some of them are just plain wrong. You don't use just 20% of your brain. It's not left brain, right brain. Both sides are being used. Actually, that's how it works best. You can catch up on sleep. So every chapter, I give something geeky, I give something interesting, I myth bust, and I also leave you know, with something you can potentially do that's free, so you don't have to go out and buy anything.
Yeah, it's one of those books that's tough to put down, but it's also made me realize that, you know, it's a really good book. I'm going to buy it for loads of people, actually, because I know more probably about my bicep than I do my brain. And my bicep's quite a simple thing to the way it works, whereas my brain seems so complex. It does seem, though, that we don't have massive knowledge of the brain, though. It's still so experimental what you guys are doing, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's take the heart. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. When I saw the first beating heart inside an open chest, I mean, it was magic. It's wrapped in the sheath, and it's like a muscular dancer writhing inside. But after a couple of those operations, you get to see it's majestic, but it's a pump. It's four chambers. It squeezes and it rings. It's got a couple of arteries on it, just a couple. And if those arteries get clogged, you get a heart attack.
Yeah.
And they did such a good job in the States. I think too many men were smoking cigars and eating steaks daily, not an indulgence.
Yeah.
And the arteries are getting clogged, and they put a lot of research behind it. Cholesterol pills, blood pressure is always checked when you go into the hospital. A whole system was built, and it lowered the risk of heart disease and clogged arteries in patients over a period of 10, 20, 30 years. My hope is that same public awareness and attention will go to brain health. Because when we were seeing patients having heart attacks in their 50s and 60s, it's interesting, we didn't live this long until recently. So the first point of failure was 50s and 60s being heavy and having a heart attack. Now people are in their 60s and 70s and 80s, and the brain is wearing out. And I just really want people to have this understanding that it's even more important than heart health. If you have seen patients with dementia, you'll know that's more important than even protecting for heart health. Hmm. And that's sort of my mission, is this is who you are. The body's just carrying you around. And I know people might say, I don't want to live that long. But what if your body outlasts your brain? That's what we're seeing now. And to me, that's a tragedy. And Ronald Reagan was a president back in the States. Lived for 5-10 years after had severe dementia.
We had Dr. Mir Krieger on this podcast, who's a sleep expert in from the States. He's fantastic, and we talked about Reagan because there's a lot of connection. We had Thatcher over here who didn't sleep. Neither of them, they both of them prided themselves on only sleeping 5 hours or under, or 4 hours or something. And he was saying there could be a correlation between lack of sleep and getting Alzheimer's and dementia. They're seeing more of that. Are you buying into that?
It's pure conjecture, but it's an interesting thought. And if you have an interesting thought, there should be a way to test that. Otherwise, it's an opinion.
Yeah.
So here's what I do know about sleep disruption. We know people who do graveyard shifts. They get more diseases. That we know.
Right.
Okay, so, and they're still sleeping during the day because our bodies evolved in a world that rotates from sunrise and sunset. We're in a diurnal pattern. And the first myth is it's not melatonin. Like, everything I'm hearing is melatonin, melatonin, melatonin. Melatonin comes from the pineal gland, which is in the back of the brain. I have removed 6 pineal glands in my life. Between my friends and me, we know of 20 to 30 patients we have removed the pineal gland. There's a publication that I mentioned. You can remove this pineal gland and get your melatonin down to 0, and there's no disruption of sleep. Hmm. This whole melatonin thing, it doesn't make sense to me from a regular guy kind of perspective. What are you talking about? I cut that gland out all the time, and the patients are fine. I know they may look a little simple, but that's the way to engage you, that I know things and see things that haven't been shared. It's actually from a suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is up in the hypothalamus, which is if you stuck your finger in your nose and went too far, it's kind of in that area.
Right.
And it regulates us. At night, it tells the genes in our body to turn on different elements of themselves. And that balance is something we grew with. You disrupt that balance. And the people who figured it out, you got a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago, you have issues, you have diseases, you have mental health issues. Does that directly lead to dementia if you are sleepless for too long? There hasn't been any proof, but it could be a contributor, but there are many contributors to that. So I don't know how to extract out just sleep being the culprit.
But sleep must be so important for the brain. And the reason why I think that is we're supposed to sleep between 7 and 9 hours. Bearing in mind, we used to have predators. We all live in houses now, so we don't. That's a hell of a long time for a mammal to go to sleep.
I love that point.
And worry about something eating us. So clearly it's important.
That's a lot of I might die time.
Exactly, yeah. we're doing it daily.
When you're getting mauled.
Yeah.
It is... So clearly sleep disruption can cause problems. Clearly sleep is important. But before we go on to why it's so important, and Margaret Thatcher maybe sleeping 5 hours, what I've seen is disrupted or interrupted sleep is bad. So whether that's my patients after surgery that I wake up every hour, and the nurses do it,
yeah,
for the first day after brain surgery, you have to wake them up every hour. They drift into something called ICU psychosis temporarily until they're allowed to sleep uninterrupted. So we know disrupted sleep is bad. Not sleeping during the nighttime is bad. So I wonder if 5 hours of good sleep, uninterrupted sleep, maybe as good as 8 hours of my kids' type of sleep, my teenager sleep, where the phone is going off, it's buzzing, you're getting off, you're turning things off. So I don't have all the answers, but disrupted sleep maybe 8 hours of disruptive sleep and 5 hours of true sleep, uninterrupted, I might take the 5 hours.
But do you know what we're actually doing when we're sleeping? Do you know what the brain's doing?
Yeah, we've got people who are measuring what's going on. So first misconception is your brain is resting, quite the opposite. Your subconsciousness is having a party. The electrodes that we put on the surface of your skull that can measure what's going on, they're not quiet. They're just different. And so it's a very important time of the day for your brain to say that all day I've been pummeled with so much stimulation, most of which I don't really need. And so during sleep, at the physical gardening level of the brain, debris and schmutz is being wheeled away. And then at the electrical level of the brain, the subconsciousness is having its way and saying, you don't need to hold on all of that. That interaction on the tube wasn't worth holding on to, because otherwise, you're giving me too much content. So it's cataloging what is important and what isn't important. So sleep is fascinating in that way, that it's almost as essential as being awake to having a healthy brain. And how to sleep better is obviously the challenge we're finding. But I just want to impart upon people, interrupted sleep, even if it's for 8 hours, is no good. Sometimes it's easier to lose a little bit of sleep if you can have true, protected, deep sleep.
What's so interesting about our brain is consciously I'm doing so little. I'm not breathing consciously. I'm not listening consciously. I'm not even looking at you consciously. I can consciously close my eyes to stop looking at you, but I can't turn off my hearing. So what is consciousness, and can you see what that looks like when you're looking at a brain on an MRI or anything?
So an MRI is an interesting thing. It's a picture of blood flow, and if you're dreaming about Mount Everest, maybe a certain region has more blood flow, and we correlate that. But you make an interesting point. The 20% of our blood flow that goes to this tiny organ, just 3 pounds, most of it is in default mode.
Yeah.
Getting up, eating, feeding, walking around. Yeah. You don't have to think about tying your shoes. It becomes procedural memory. You don't have to even think about getting home. And frankly, you don't even have to be conscious to do a lot of those things. I'm not driving home. I'm not saying you can drive home without being conscious, but you know, some of us can daze off and even doze off and get home. But if a boxer knocks you out, you're lying on the ground breathing.
Yeah.
So that acreage in the brain is always there despite consciousness. But what happens with consciousness is the scientific mystery of eternity. How does flesh sprout consciousness? To me, that is the essential piece. And the best guess when I flip through those things is we don't know. But it has to do with like reverberations and oscillations, like a symphony when it starts, it's the sounds aren't all together, then they get into a flow. And consciousness, when you measure electricity, it's like aurora borealis. It's like a swarm of birds. There's something electrical going on that's not very linear, and it's not one tube station to another. There's an energy flow state that is consciousness, because sometimes we have people who their eyes are open, but they're not conscious. There's a strange area in the frontal lobes where you have abulia. They wake up, but they won't engage you. From those patients, I launched a chapter on creativity, because you're awake, your eyes are open, but there's no initiation. There's no ambition. There can be no creativity. So what consciousness is a very difficult topic to tackle, but we know it's not this part of the brain makes you have some consciousness. This part of the brain makes, it's not like that. There are energy waves and flows inside the brain, and then you have this sort of meta thing on top that's us right now. Mm. And you can lose that and still talk, and we call them walk and talk. When patients, can they walk and talk? That's the first thing before even consciousness. You can lose consciousness and still be sitting there and feed yourself in the hospital, and your eyes are open and you're in this zombie state. Is that consciousness? So it's a fascinating topic. Again, I think brain surgeons collaborating or also being neuroscientists are the ones that are going to have the best window to that. I don't have the answer to that, but thank you for asking me that question.
Well, Raoul, it got me thinking so much. And then so something that I take for granted is a memory, right? Yeah, I understand that there's no part of my body which is over 9 years old or something like that. Let's just take that as some sort of fact. So my brain's always rejuvenating, yet somehow I can remember things a lot older than that. How is my brain retaining memories, even sums, basic sums and stuff? Do we have any understanding of how this is happening?
At the molecular level, not so much. But I'll tell you what we do know about the brain.
Okay.
It's not not all parts of it are being replaced every 9 years. So if we take the brain to be a garden, there are about 80 billion roses, call them neurons.
Right.
The jellyfish, the sprouters of electricity. But there are also 80 billion shrubs around it, supporting cells, astrocytes and glia. Those are turning over constantly. And then the neurons you have when you're born, you have most of them as you get less young. We found out in the last 10, 20 years, and I did my PhD on it, there are certain areas, not all over, where you have these niches, these germinal niches. We use a lot of landscape terms. These are neuroscientific terms that can still spew and release a few more neurons. And where do those new neurons go? They go to olfaction in mice, because people experiment with mice, and mice are heavily olfaction dependent.
What's olfaction mean?
Olfaction meaning smell.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So they're smell dependent. So they tend to stream new roses, plant new roses in the area for smell. And humans, if there is neural stem cell and neural regeneration, it tends to go to the temporal lobes, the hippocampus, where memory is. So there may be actually a structural, a physical planting of more material in the garden area that takes care of memory. What it does when it gets there, and how it's actually, how do we remember, is again a mystery. But we know certain things from perturbation of the system. We know decades ago, surgeons cut out a temporal lobe and the person couldn't remember the last conversation they had. And they kept driving back to where they lived 30 years ago. So then we're like, wait a second. So there's short-term memory and then there's long-term memory. We know when Alzheimer's happens, and there's a different type of Alzheimer's, different type of dementia, if you will, it's called frontotemporal. When that temporal lobe, again, where the hippocampus is, wears away, grandma and grandpa can't find themselves home. So that's why they have to be in these places where the doors are locked, because they'll get lost. So now we're like, oh, there's a spatial memory. And the only thing at a molecular level that I found was in the spatial memory, the neuroscientists are a phenomenal bunch, much more talented than me. They ask exotic questions. I'm more simple, like, this part comes out and I know this was gone. I can connect the dots. I can connect the dots for a cocktail conversation, which is probably why this has been working. But there are grid cells, G-R-I-D, that literally cells that are oriented like a pattern. So you know if you're left or right or up or down or north or south. And so we're putting those pieces together. The type of memory I want to have most of is not remembering phone numbers. It's not remembering addresses. Thank God for the computer in our pockets. It's this thing called working memory, what am I doing today? I have 10 things to do today. Can I pull them all off seamlessly? Can I juggle leaving here, going there, what's next, cooking for dinner, fighting with the boss, making dinner, picking up the kids? That too is a memory. How many plates can you juggle that all day multitasking, not at this moment multitasking? That's called working memory. That's the memory that makes people more capable in their day. That's the memory I think I would like to have more of. But where is it a filing cabinet? No. And then there's some weird, bizarre stuff where they started tickling parts of the brain with those brain catheters that are giving these tiny little shocks because it's an electric thing. And people improved their memory. People with Alzheimer's had improved memory. So it's a fascinating landscape, but I cannot take you down to the cellular level about where and how memory works and resides.
Yeah, you might as well explain, because it's interesting, what a brain actually is. Because we think it's a muscle, but it's not, is it? Yeah. And the way you describe it, it's quite yucky, really. Because
I thought it was beautiful the way I was describing it.
it sort of is, but
too
I just
much for you.
Well, I just imagined it was a muscle, and then you said no, it's more like a flan. You put your finger in it, it'll keep going all the way through, and you're going, oh, really?
Ew. I see what you're saying about flan. Yeah, bread pudding and flan. The texture is like nothing else. And part of becoming a brain surgeon, you go through other training, so I've operated all over the body.
Right.
First of all, it's white. And I said, this is a total tangent. But I had a patient, he was a butcher. And I said, well, you got some issues there where I explained it to him where the brain comes down and turns into the spinal cord right here at the base of the skull.
Yeah. Because
if the jellyfish is trapped in the skull, its tentacles have to exit. And there's a hole at the bottom of the skull.
Yeah.
Foramen magnum. And he said to me, that white shiny part when we cut the animals up. I said, wait, that was extremely visceral explanation. But it is flesh, but it's not red.
Oh.
But it gets way more blood than your bicep. And the bicep is red. Your heart is red. It's white.
Why?
But it's exactly right. Exactly. That's why it's like, what is this? This is that's when I first saw, I was actually going to be a heart surgeon. When they opened the skull and I had the opportunity to potentially be in neurosurgery, I was just like, what is that? All this blood and flesh in our scalps. And then the skull has this bony texture. And then you get past the skull like ice fishing. You make a circle. And you still don't see the brain. It's in a sheath. Like about the thickness of a parachute material.
Right.
And so then there's this sheath and it's plump. And then you pick up the sheath like with a tweezer. You get just a tiny thing, little cut, and you insert an instrument in it, and you kind of zip it open like ripping a blazer or a dress.
Uh-huh.
And then all this white, clear white fluid. It's filled with proteins and nutrients and even diseases, but it's clear and odorless, unlike blood, unlike all the other juices. So you get this clear fluid that's providing the buoyancy in a floating aquarium, and then there's this white, gently throbbing, undulating thing called the brain. It's you have to see it once if you can. You can't because you're not a surgeon, but it's something that you would say, this is completely different. And then you get those iconic ridges.
Yeah.
And what those are, and other animals don't have them, and unfortunately people who aren't engaged or have brain injury, they can lose those too as kids. It's basically like trying to take a pizza and crunching it together like an accordion to put it into a box.
Mm-hmm.
The ridges just give you more square footage or square acreage on the canopy because the thoughts, think of it as a mushroom, the thoughts are on the canopy.
Right.
So the surface of your brain is sparking all the thoughts. And then underneath it, the rest of the brain, the part you don't see, it's just crisscrossing pathways. And so when you see that top of the brain, that undulating pattern, the serpentine blood vessels is like a Jackson Pollock painting. It's something quite brilliant to see. And the operating room lights really put it under quite a bit of shine. And it's such an amazing thing.
So when you're operating on this, let's say you're taking away a tumor. When you're going in, you're taking a tumor out of the brain. Where are you taking it out of? The white bit in the middle?
Brilliant question. I think that's probably the first time a non-surgeon doctor has asked that. Exactly. Wait a second. So you've got the brain, and there's a deep-seated tumor.
Mm-hmm.
But the pathway to the tumor is healthy brain.
Yeah.
How are you going to get to that? Well, there are corridors within the brain that we can simply forgive the indelicacy, bulldoze through and dissect and get to that deeper core, the nucleus where the tumor is, shell it out, collapse it onto itself, and suck it out of that channel we have made. So the biggest part of neurosurgery is learning what parts of the brain you can simply go through and what parts you can't. And that's the first thing you learn is, wait a second, we know since we have two frontal lobes and two occipital lobes, those are safe passages to the deep brain. We know language is on the left. Oh man, don't even think about it. And in fact, when you see a scan and the patient has an issue on the left, the dominant hemisphere, right away, we call it the dominant hemisphere, the left, yeah. Because of language. It tends to be on the left, even if you're left-handed. So we say, oh, this is going to be tough for the patient, tough for us. So there are places we can part and essentially gently divide through a narrow tunnel and get to deep-seated tumors. So there's that amount of redundancy in certain parts of the brain. Excellent question.
And you sometimes have to keep them awake.
Yeah.
Because you don't know where you're going to. So you have to, you don't want them to lose their language, and it's quite close to the language. So you have to, is this right? You keep them awake. In your book. So you keep them awake and they have to, so that they don't feel any pain.
When you, you know, I'm 46 and you drive home when you've helped somebody by operating on a human brain while the patient is awake. They're your co-pilot. They're talking. Oh, you know what God. You feel? You feel like, why are they paying me for that? That is the ultimate privilege to have that ability for that patient and to have learned a skill where I can actually be chosen by the patient, because there are many neurosurgeons in Los Angeles. We have a lot of centers, London, Los Angeles, New York. They have come to me for a rare skill that a handful of us have here. And they are trusting me, not just what I'm going to do with their brain, but you mean I'm going to be naked with a gown in a room full of strangers and you're going to be the conductor that opens up my skull and then wakes me up lightly and starts talking to me? That's a lot of trust.
Yeah,
you can't not feel good about what you have been fortunate to help people with, this craft. And why do we do that? Because most of the things that are complicated, emotion, love, pain, consciousness, they're global. But language, oddly enough, is local. It has a neighborhood. It's got a borough. It's left temporal lobe. But we don't know which house it is in that borough. So while thinking about going through that cortical canopy, getting to the middle of the tree, getting past the shell of the mushroom, we have to figure out, okay, I gotta get into the left temporal lobe, but I can't ruin their language because it's on the surface. So when we put them under anesthesia, then we lighten up the anesthesia. There's no tube in their mouth. It's a little bit like being at the dentist, a little bit like laughing gas, but more sophisticated in what we're giving them. First, we numb up the scalp while they're under, because the scalp hurts. Then we make the hole, and then we open that sheath, because parachute-like sheath also has little nerves on it. Though, if I touch the sheath, you will know I touched the sheath. Oh. But once I open the sheath, the brain can only feel through its emissaries and tentacles called the nerves. You can touch the brain on an awake patient, and they won't know they've been touched. So it's insensate in that weird way directly. So that's what allows you to operate on a awake patient, otherwise they would hurt. But where is language? And it's not, you know, people don't understand. It's fundamental. If you hurt language, it's not like you can resort to texting. You destroy the concept of language. They'll look at you like, well, why are you moving your lips? It's a devastating injury. Many of us in the field consider it to be a fate worse than death. And so you have to get that right. So they wake up. And you have these little, think about like a blunt fountain pen, but a little, you know, like a forked tip.
Yeah.
It's blunt. And it shoots a tiny little current in between. Again, they don't feel. And the current stuns that region that's between the tines, if you will. And so you say, okay, let's count together. You know, count for me backwards from 10. 10, 9, 8, and I zap without telling them when I'm zapping. And if they can keep counting, I put a little piece of confetti on there that says, this part, if I have to, I can go through this.
Right.
And you do that all around that area, and you put red and white. And sometimes, count backwards, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, and I zap a little spot the size of a piece of confetti. And it's like a, it's like a robot that can't talk. They just, they can't get the word out. It's called speech arrest. So hypothetically, it would go like this. Sure, Dr. John Diel, 10, 9, 8, just pause. It's a speech arrest, and I put a red piece of confetti. You map the surface of the temporal lobe that way, and then you've established where you can make the Swiss cheese holes, and those will be your tiny little portals deep into the temporal lobe to cut out the tumor. It's a fascinating thing that tells us about language. And if you have two languages, this is just the bizarrest thing. I don't know why. If you have two languages, if you hurt the mother tongue, you lose all subsequent tongues.
So if your primary language is English, but you learn Spanish, you lose
everything. Right. But if I go through just Spanish, he'll still have English.
So how long is this?
Yeah,
really.
But this, you're saying what? But I could pull a paper from 30 years ago that we've known this. So a lot of this is, I mean, it's new science, but it's new to you.
Yeah.
And I'm mining the vaults of what I've been seeing for the last 10, 20 years to bring it to you.
How long is one of those operations then? Sounds like it's going to take forever.
3 hours.
3 hours. That's a long time to concentrate.
For the surgeon,
it's
a little bit like flying. We don't have to concentrate the whole flight. So pilots concentrate takeoff and landing. We don't really concentrate when we're cutting scalp. It's instinctive.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's scalp. I mean, scalp, there's bone underneath it. Yeah. You can't really mess that up. But those parts of surgery are like tying shoelaces.
But do you have to sew it up at all as you come out of the brain, as you get the parachute material? Does any of this have to be sealed?
That's a fantastic question. This is a great conversation. On the way out, you do a pretty stitch with this long tweezer called a Castro Viejo. Versace and grandma, the seamstress, and everybody would be impressed. You do a pretty stitch because right before you leave, you close that parachute, and you do a pretty stitch until the last throw where you've got like a little blowhole, if you will, and you take a syringe with a blunt tip and you fill that aquarium back up and pull the last stitch. So you leave the brain floating in just sterile water.
Right.
And it'll make its own fluid over the next 1 to 2 days. But yeah, we call it a watertight closure to get it back into its buoyant fluid environment. Excellent questions. You would have been a great instructor of surgery. I don't know about performer of surgery. That's a different skill. So the best surgeons aren't necessarily the ones who are the best at the tests, you know.
They have to be the most.
There's something different.
Yeah.
You know that with athletes and dancers, there's something more than just smarts that makes it happen.
Well, it's fascinating meeting you, because when you read your book, you can tell you're enthusiastic about your skills and your job and your career. When you actually meet you in real life, you've got a lovely sparkle about you as you're talking, going into the brain. You clearly love your job.
And I love the patient stories. What better way to understand humanity? You have a great opportunity to meet people. I meet them in their crises. I meet them in their triumphs. I meet all different types of people. And I meet them routinely. Every week I'm meeting 20 new people. Every week I'm operating on 3 or 4 different people. And I'm in a world where I'm constantly engaged with a wide range of people in the widest range of emotions. And I think that's the best part about my job.
Is the majority of your work removal then of the brain?
Oh, a good question. So I'm a cancer brain surgeon now.
Right.
Before I did trauma surgery. There is a whole world which you would find fascinating is neuromodulation. You can do it with magnets from the skull. Way back when I was telling somebody they stuck electric fish on people's heads when they had migraines, knowing that the electricity could change the electricity inside the skull. That is extended to deep brain stimulation, where you're not cutting out bad things. You're not pulling out blood clots and cancers. You're actually saying the pills aren't working for your depression. Your OCD is so bad that you can't leave the house. No other medicines are working. We know it's from an instinctive region of your brain called the subcortical structures, you know, the thalamus, the globus pallidus, they're beneath the canopy. We can stick a tiny wire in there and tickle it with a generator on your chest, much like a Cardiac patients have that.
Yeah.
We put one the same place, but rather than drop the wire on the surface of the heart, we tunnel it up and drop it into the deep part of the brain. That deep brain stimulation, without injuring the brain, can change those oscillations we were talking about. And it can change the way you feel about things that create fear for you, that create worry for you, that create obsessive compulsive disorder for you, that create excessive eating for you. So these instinctive drives and worries can be modulated without injuring the brain. And you say, how do you do that? I don't know, but it's been going on for decades. And I remember this very distinctive case that I had. If you don't get the tip in the right spot, and there are ways to do that, if you go too far, you can actually give the patient a sensation of fear. Like you could see them grimace in the operating room, because some of those are done awake as well. I did one for Nat Geo. I did a show with them and that was on there. So we know some primal things happen there, and we can modulate it without hurting you and actually without knowing why it works. And so, as you said, we're just beginning to know why, even though we've been tinkering with brains and fixing their output, the mechanisms and mechanics underlying it is going to make for an exciting next 10 to 20 years.
You just mentioned migraines there. You said your brain doesn't feel anything when you're going in and digging around. So why have you got pain in your head when you have a migraine? You
remember that sheath I was telling you about that still has nerves? So if I do it and break brain surgery, I know the scalp feels.
Yeah.
I know the skull feels.
Yeah.
I know inside the skull that sheath feels, but at the surface of the brain doesn't. A lot of headaches arise from that sheath that covers the brain.
Right. So from that's what, though? What's happening? Do we know?
We don't know. I think many people think it's excessive blood flow. That's why caffeine sometimes helps, because caffeine shrinks blood vessels. That's the way. If you look at Excedrin, it's caffeine plus a painkiller. If you look at the back, something about mixed migraine. People have migraines will tell you, you know, they'll take an anti-inflammatory and they'll take a shot of espresso. One of my kids used to have migraines, and when it was coming on, shot espresso and 3 Advil.
See, I used to get migraines a lot. They started happening weekly, and it was blurred vision, headache, nausea, that sort of stuff, usual sort of stuff. And then I was on a flight to New York, and in it there was some article, and the person said it might be excessive sugar. So I cut out all sugar for a year. Immediately went, and I was like, wow, how can that be connected to sugar? I mean, it's just...
I don't know. Right. I don't know the answer to that. But the triggers for migraines vary between people, and the things that cool off the headaches vary as well. But I don't have a molecular understanding.
You mentioned OCD and things like that just a minute ago. The big talking point over here at the moment constantly is mental health and depression.
Sure.
That's obviously something which is happening in our mind, in our brains.
Absolutely.
Do we have any understanding of what's happening there, and how, and will people like you be able to treat it in the future or now?
Well, if we look at depression as both an electrical and a chemical imbalance, we know it's a chemical imbalance because these pills, whether you take them or not or believe in them or not, but we know that serotonin is one of those magical chemicals that sprays between the tentacles of these 100 billion neurons. And when it's too low, we have something called a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, Prozac, whatever it is. What it does is it lifts the levels of serotonin by vacuuming them out less within those gaps between our tentacles. So we know it's a chemical disease. Those chemicals have charges on them that create electricity. We know also it's an electrical disease because those deep brain stimulating wires sometimes help with depression. And again, so it's both at a very tiny cellular and molecular level, an imbalance in the chemistry. We also know that there's also an imbalance. Mood, again, is global. There's going to be differences in those electrical oscillations. And we also know that it tends to sprout when the brain is doing its most passionate reorganization, which is late 18, 19 years of age, early 20s, there's a spike in schizophrenia at that age. So we know that there's a genetic component. We know there's a timing component when it arises. We know there's a chemical component, an electrical component. We know that there's a situational component. If your child passes away, you're in depression, that's actually appropriate. if you're there's nothing ruining your life or stressing your life out, and you or things are going great, but you just feel so gloomy, it makes no sense. That we know is pathological. So I don't have a specific answer for you about depression, but I wanted to let you know again, it's not a simple thing, as nothing in the brain is. And the best way to start understanding is to say it's an electrical imbalance, it's a chemical imbalance, it's a situational imbalance, and how can we help people? That's where you start getting into things like, okay, you take medicine, but you need therapy as well for somebody to coach you out of it. Or this new thing called ketamine that used to be a rave drug, now is approved as a mist to spray into the nose. It's got this rapid onset of improvement of depression, and we don't know why. So there are all these parameters, and if you understand the brain is electrical and chemical as well as contextual, then your therapy can be built around those three prongs as well.
Sorry to knock your country, but after prohibition with alcohol, you decided to do prohibition with drugs, just as psychedelics, MDMA, and various other ketamine you just mentioned there were actually being used for to help the brain, to rewire it and stuff. Now I think it's opening up again. Obviously, cannabis as well. America are leading the way on this, bizarrely, now after them being the ones who decided to stop us all doing it. Are you sad that in the 60s we were stopped from doing this? Because I think it seems to have an effect, doesn't it? Psychedelics on the brain and things to change it.
I could talk about this for hours, and that wouldn't be good for anybody. But I was in Berkeley in the 90s. Everybody was trying to relive the 60s there. We were just two decades behind.
Right.
Let me tell you some interesting stories about that. The use of psilocybin is now, which is a psychedelic, is being considered at cancer centers in clinical trials. For patients who have been diagnosed with cancer and feel an existential crisis, gosh, what is happening to me? Something inside my body. It wasn't an infection that came and hurt me. I grew a cancer inside me. It's a terrible feeling for some people. And people are looking at psilocybin for that at American cancer centers. So the mind is opening to them. And in a controlled environment, it's not like cocaine where your blood vessels explode in your head. It's not like heroin where you may never take a breath again, but you do need a coach through that process. And America has become open-minded, at least in that way, to consider that in medical centers. When I was in the 90s and I was volunteering at San Francisco General Hospital, AIDS was, that's the epicenter of studying it. AIDS was a scourge. And they weren't eating. They were cachectic. They weren't eating. They were starting to pass around marijuana there as a way to eat. It is available to cancer patients again after chemotherapy because it is an appetite stimulant. And so all of these things are taking a renewed interest. MDMA ecstasy, made for marriage counseling and then shown to have some addictive potential, is coming back as potential treatment for PTSD, in which a way to recontextualize what has happened to your life. And to me, you know, I'm not an advocate of drugs, but I'm also not an advocate of telling people what to do and creating policy. I'm not that guy. There's no shortcut. There's no let's make this policy. I just want to tell people what I know. Buyer beware, I'm telling you the truth. It might make you like some things, not like some things, but you deserve to know. How dare I sugarcoat something and prepackage something as all drugs are bad, all drugs are not bad, or alcohol is allowed but marijuana is illegal. It's not complicated enough for your brain or my brain. And I think what psychedelics can offer, microdosing in Silicon Valley, which is a weird thing to me to see, like tech geeks
they
on
do,
acid.
Don't they?
I'm just like, really? Is that, there's, you know, I'm thinking it should be more Berkeley and Haight-Ashbury, but they think that it can help them with creativity, elusive search for creativity. We're all wildly creative in our dreams. Children are wildly creative. Sometimes people who drink write some interesting things. All of those things, the frontal lobe is getting out of the way. You're losing the inhibition. The boss is out of town.
So is the frontal lobe the bit which controls?
Yeah. It's the CEO.
It's the consciousness.
Yeah. Right. Well, consciousness is like just being aware.
Right.
Coming to, like the robot, you know, waking up. But the frontal lobes are sometimes so preoccupied by getting on the tube, getting home on time, and checking and sending emails. Oh my gosh, sending emails that you didn't even need to send. Clicking, deleting, spam emails that you didn't even need to. And then there's no room for creativity because you're a checklist person rather than a creative person. So what's unique about all of that is getting the frontal lobe out of the way. So creativity, when people take acid and they take the brain scans and stuff like that, my best explanation is we have these major, the aurora borealis and the swarm of oscillations, all that magical stuff I was talking about, it tends to go in certain areas. They're still patterned.
Mm.
And so I like to think of those as freeways, entrenched ruts, broad paths that we have realized are reliable to get things done. Acid and these psychedelics, they, at a biological level, they disrupt all those established pathways. The LA freeways are gone, the tube is gone.
You're forced
to make connections and end up in places you wouldn't otherwise. Most of it is just maybe not useful, but on occasion you can have a clever thought on it. And I think that's the seductive nature of psychedelics for creativity.
So I'm going to ask you a deep question because you've actually been in brains and we haven't. Do you believe in free will?
I mean, there's suicide. That's free will driving the brain to hurt itself. So it goes against all programming, all the drive to preserve, all the fight flight that we always hear about.
Mm.
If that imbalance goes off far enough, it will hurt itself. I mean, that is free will in some sense, no?
I haven't thought about it like that. Yeah. I've always thought about it in the nice way. But that's interesting because that's a really different way of looking at it. I've never thought about that. And I've been intrigued by free will. I listen to a lot of people like Sam Harris and stuff talk, who you know, and he's sort of anti-free will, isn't he, really? He thinks that we're just machines.
Oh, no.
We take inputs and we
got a second example for you.
Go on.
Cancer is just chewing on a bone in your leg and it is this the greatest amount of pain that anybody could imagine. Mm. There's free will there. Now, although in the States you cannot ask for the final blow, if you will, you cannot ask for a poison or maybe it's not even a poison. You cannot ask to be let go. If there are devices we have put in you, a breathing machine,
mm-hmm.
a feeding tube, your free will can say, no, it's not worth it anymore. And please take out this feeding, a simple little plastic straw.
Yeah.
You have the power to say, take this out. I'm not going to eat and I'm going to let myself go. So I see things in a different perspective because of my experiences.
There's a fascinating story that I can't remember the guy's name, but there was a guy, I think he was in America, and he killed, I think, a load of people. And he said, please, can you look at my brain?
Mm.
When I die, because I think it was the last message he left, because I'm not feeling right. And apparently this happened quite a lot. They opened his brain up and he had a tumor,
mm-hmm.
which affected his thought process. Mm-hmm. Is this what happens with tumor?
Depends on the location.
Right.
And that's an interesting one. I'm not sure I'm qualified to go into, is there a biological basis for criminal inclinations and stuff like that? But there was a different story. I think there was a nun who had this passionate connection with God.
Yeah.
And there was a benign tumor in the temporal lobe.
Right.
And it was growing and it was about to hurt her. And it's not my patient, I read about it.
Yeah.
And then there was the conundrum, if you take it out, will I lose my passionate connection?
Yeah.
It was something. And interestingly enough, there is a syndrome. I don't remember the name. It may be Gerstmann's, but they get this thing where they write a lot. The brain. You know, you're not going to get this with a knee. Being a knee surgeon for a lifetime is not going to give you this.
No.
But no disrespect to my colleagues that do that. I'm just happy with what I chose. I hope you are too. I'm not.
Yeah.
You get micrographia, which is small writing,
uh-huh.
and hypergraphia. You write a lot. And then you get this thing called hyper-religiosity. What is that? What kind of word is that? And it makes people prone to profound religious thoughts and And some people thought, well, maybe a lot of these people who've written these great books or wherever this is arising from is a welcome injury or disease of the brain that has drifted people into this thing. It's in the temporal lobe, which is, to me, the soul. And they have temporal lobe. And even if you have a tumor, it's called TLE, temporal lobe epilepsy. Aberrant electricity in the temporal lobe makes people have these things. They smell fire when we tickle that part of the temporal lobe. They can smell, they can see demons, they can remember things. It's a interesting, interesting place in the brain to operate.
See, if I was a superstar lawyer, especially in the States where this sort of stuff could happen, I would be spending a lot of time going to brain experts, going, how much is conscious and how much is self-conscious? Yeah. So
it's not all his fault. All right, give him the full sentence. Yeah,
it's not his fault because the he's had all these pathways open since he was a kid. Yeah. He came from a bad home. It's not his fault or her fault anymore. And I think, you know, as we go on and we're working out how much is conscious and how much is not your consciousness. I think that might be a good defense for people.
It might be. I won't
in
be
future.
The neuroscientist to call. 'Cause I believe in free will.
It's my defense anyway. if ever I do something. Now, finally on this, I've got to talk about how to have good brain health. The first thing we've got to talk about is when you describe it in your book, you suddenly realize how delicate a brain is, really. It's in the skull, which is, you know, quite solid. But then we're just whooshing around in this water, this liquid, as you say. Obviously, the big thing we think about, I've played a lot of sport in my time, soccer, heading footballs. Then you've got American football and rugby over here, banging heads, concussion. There's a lot of talk about that. Are we all mad to be engaging in sports? Boxing. MMA. MMA's massive now, isn't it? UFC, MMA, mixed martial arts. The pounding of the head. Surely this can't be good for us.
Yeah, but I want to be allowed to make bad decisions. I do. And I tell my kids that. I just don't want to be lied to about them.
Right.
So we never doubted that the boxers were going to get pugilistica dementia. There's some old phrase about it. We knew they got punched drunk. But when NFL... misguided people that these helmets were okay, and they made these commercials where the helmets were banging, welcome to Monday Night Football, boom, and harder the hit the better. When you deceive people about the risks, therein lies to me the problem. And now everyone should know, playing American football and rugby and banging your head and for whichever situation, you know, falling off a table too many times, that it will hurt you. Just like boxers knew before going into boxing, this could mess me up. So similar with cigarettes. For a while, they were saying they weren't dangerous.
Yeah.
Therein lies the problem. Now that we know they're dangerous, if you want to occasionally have one, that's not my role to say yes or no. And what I tell my kids is, if you asked me, three teenage boys, and frankly, you know, if you need to play football to make it out of a living environment, that's your path forward, you should have that right. You just need to know this could hurt you. And hey, here are some steps you can take. Like if you get a concussion, you got to cool it off for a week. You can't go back in the game to win the game because that's when you're really going to hurt yourself the second hit. But I tell them, if I said, go ahead and bang your knee, same knee, on the wall, 30 times a day, 4 days a week for 10 years. I said, come on, Dad, I'm gonna mess up my knee. Why did we ever think any differently about our brains sloshing around inside our skull? How do we get to that sort of loss of common sense? That's my position on it. It hurts you. Now you know.
But you yeah, interesting in the book, you do say the brain's quite good at healing itself. Mm-hmm. It can actually start that, you know, with the concussion, if you wait long enough, you can be all right. You're not saying definitely all right, but you can be all
right.
That's
a good point. It's a chronic thing. It's not one knock. Plenty of kids fall off the kitchen counter or fall out of bed. Mm. It's the chronic repeated bumps. Can the brain heal itself? In some ways, yes. In some ways, it's terribly resilient.
But you've operated on people who then can't walk, mm-hmm. and then you go about a few months later, and the brain has taught itself to do the pathways again to get the left side working as well as the right, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And what's interesting is the most stark example that reveals that is it's not rewiring. I think we like that phrase because we're in the computer time.
Right, okay.
And then people talk about gear. It's okay. I think of it that way too. But it's repurposing.
Right.
Because if we cut out a large portion of your brain, forget what the indication is. And these stark examples, they illustrate. I'm not suggesting to do this. And I don't want anybody to be put off by it, but we learned a lot from injury. And we learned a lot from the injuries we delivered accidentally decades ago. Unintentionally, but it was an immature science. You can remove a fourth to maybe even a half of a kid's brain. You can take a right hemisphere and they'll be paralyzed on the opposite side. So the left arm and their left leg is hurt if you remove the right hemisphere. It's usually done for uncontrollable epilepsy. It's either do that or live on a breathing machine underneath, you know, Michael Jackson drug propofol. That's no life either. So it's two bad scenarios. Some of them, many of them, a couple years later, come back. And now that injured side is moving again.
Amazing.
And so, but the brain, if you look at the scan, that spot is still hollow. It's not like it resprouted. It's not like the shrub grew again. It's just whatever was left started doing more. A ballerina turned into a footballer. An intellectual turned into something else. The cells that are there can repurpose themselves for different functions. So it's not like new wires are created. It's just new roles are taking on. So I'm trying to think about, how do you describe that? It's just repurposing, you know?
We can now replace things in our bodies constantly, can't we? You know, we've got various
metal
things.
Metal and transplant, yeah.
We're so far away from sticking anything in a brain, aren't we, to help it?
Well, there's two things we can stick in. One, those brain catheters that I was telling you about underneath the canopy, those subcortical structures where we can tickle the brain.
Tickle the brain, yeah.
We do leave those. Those are implanted.
Right, okay.
And the other things we're leaving in the brain after cancer surgery are cells, living cells that we have armed with chemotherapy that at a molecular level chase around the cancer we can't get to with our scalpel, and they spew chemotherapy on our mortal enemy, the individual cancer cell.
That's incredible.
We are spraying living, throbbing cells that go on and stay behind for a month or two and continue to do what we can't with just our scalpels.
That's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's a joy too.
So what's the one, is there anything that you think we could, I'm going to ask you my questions in a minute, I'll ask everyone. Have you been, has someone told you these or not?
I have not looked at those.
Oh, okay.
But I'll just fire them.
Okay, they're just some quick questions. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Take the circuitous route. Think about obliquity. If you have the luxury of wanting something, don't just go right after it directly. Cultivate different talents and skills and find yourself tangentially in front of that opportunity. That's how it's happened for me. I dropped out of university. I was a security guard for 2 years. I took time out of brain surgery training. And I do feel like those are those chances I took, safe chances, but chances, or what led me to have this magical day in London today. Yeah.
How long does it take to become a brain surgeon?
So university after high school is 4, medical school is 4, and then, so that's already 8.
Yeah.
And then there's another 7 for brain surgery, and then another 4 at least for a PhD. So it's 8 plus 7, yeah.
How long before you're any good?
That is a whole book in itself. That is a magical, nuanced world that only people within it could explain. In my opinion, you need to not graduate some people you have led into. You take people into surgical training without ever seeing them play the piano, dance, kick a soccer ball. You let them in, just on high marks.
Right.
And they say, go ahead and perform this incredibly technical task. And then you graduate almost all of them. There's something about that does not make sense to the regular guys I know. What are you talking about? We couldn't do that in construction work. So there's a flaw there. And so some never get good, is my one answer. And then those of us that do, it takes about 4 or 5 years. I think, I'm 46. I think a surgeon in their early 40s after 5 years under their belt is a nice spot. But then some of us become so specialized on rare things. You can choose a 40-year-old surgeon, if you will, or you could have a 65-year-old master of the craft that has just seen so many of these rare things, he or she is no longer a dabbler. that's a value as well.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing. It's an artistic thing. It's often thought of as like changing an engine and you complete these 200 steps. Oh no, we can skip steps. There are steps some surgeons can perform that others can't.
Right.
And it's never talked about in that way. So I would love to, maybe that's the next thing I'll be thinking about when I fly back.
Yeah, you should. That's a fascinating thing. Well, this, you sort of covered the next question. I've got this question about mistakes and what mistakes people do in your job, or there are mistakes, you know. And I suppose that's, it's self, too much confidence or not learning the skills or not having the skills, I suppose. Is that something that say, or is there
the
anything
mistakes
else?
Mistakes in surgery are people who do not acknowledge their limitations.
Right.
They're past their depth.
Yeah.
And it's, the mistakes are, you shouldn't have been doing that operation.
Yeah.
You knew that. We knew that. But the patient didn't know that.
Mm.
And now you're having a complication because you were just past your depth.
But you need that confidence. I can tell you're a confident guy, but you need it. If you're gonna take someone's skull off and go into their brain, you're gonna have to be confident.
Right, but and not all neurosurgeons do that. A lot of them do only spinal surgery. Not all of neurosurgery is dangerous. So here's the best part. So many times, the more challenging operation does not pay more.
Yeah.
So why not just leave it to the people that are into the craft for the glory? Why not just change the knees and pinch nerves, do the cosmetic stuff, make a living, be a surgeon? Let us have the Mount Everest to climb for the patients.
But do you leave the surgery and go, that's it, I've left the patient now, I'm going to get on and go and watch whatever I'm going to watch on TV, and you know, and or do you stay with that patient mentally throughout the whole day? And
no, you know, I think that's the difference between you know, anesthesia, they go home. You know, the clock ticks, the next person takes over.
Yeah.
Until that patient is out of the hospital and better, he or she is my responsibility.
Wow, 24 okay. That's tough.
They're in my mind.
That's tough.
But I always wait till they wake up.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if you do things structurally perfectly, you never know if that consciousness and those oscillations are gonna trigger the right way. So we always, all neurosurgeons, we'll see how they wake up.
Mm-hmm.
That's our way of saying, it was masterful what I did with my hands. I don't know what I'm going to get. And therein lies also the excitement that you can never master, because you don't know what you're going to get. So we always wait till they wake up. We you know, they, my students would tell me, he woke up, they're talking and moving. Okay. Now I can start heading to my car.
Final couple of questions. I've got this question, any life hacks, but I wonder if you can give us life hacks on how to get the most out of your brain. I started brushing my teeth left-handed because someone told me it was a good idea. I'm right-handed. Yeah.
Use left-handed chopsticks.
Yeah. Right. You do that in your book, you say. You eat with chopsticks left-handed. Are you right-handed, I assume?
Yeah, I'm right-hand dominant. If I have to make a pass to win the Super Bowl, I will be throwing with my right hand. But I try to bring my left hand in as much as I can, partly just because at neurosurgery is two-handed craft.
Right.
Not all surgery is. There are a lot of people who rely really heavily on one hand.
So you're training yourself all the time, left hand.
I
want to
be better at it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. I want to be the best at it for the patients. My competitive spirit, it reveals itself when I can hurt people less, because there's no way to do brain surgery and not have complications, than the people down the street. That's what separates me, is I want to be the one that says, these group of patients, they chose me because I'm a master at this.
Right. Group.
That's where I get my sense of pride.
So what else can we do to help our brains?
Well, you know, I'll take you through a quick 24-hour day. I think if you wake up once in a while, skip breakfast, that lets those ketones come in. I'm not promoting any kind of diet. I'm just letting you know the brain is a hybrid vehicle. Go without food for 16 hours once in a while if you can. I would bring in meditative breathing, just deep breathing. It's not mindfulness or thinking about the top of a mountain or yoga mat in Malibu. It's just slow, deep, controlled breathing. It's free. It has an electrically calming effect on the brain that has been proven by us measuring the electricity with actual surface grids on top of the brain. I would pivot the diet to include more, you know, plants and fish and less meat and fried food. Those subtle changes when you do eat can help. I would try to stay vertical. You know, everybody's, you know, I see these fitness posters and all these people are in great shape, and most of the people I know, they look at that and like, that's never going to be me. What I'm saying is, don't chase it for the vanity. I'm not saying I don't.
Yeah.
I'm saying it still benefits you to get out of that chair and stand. If my patients can stand, you could see a withering plant grow again.
Right.
I don't know what it is. Just be vertical.
Yeah.
The sitting on the couch, sitting on the chairs, it's killing us. So be vertical. Next thing you know, it leads to a little walk. And next thing you know, it leads to some steps. So getting to your next level of activity will have your brain say, I'm going to shower myself with growth factors. I'm going to keep those arteries open so the flesh of the brain doesn't wither. And it starts a slow process. The problem, I think, sometimes is just too much expectation. You're going to go from being a couch potato to having a, you know, six packs of abs. That's a disconnect. And I know that from my kids when they play video games. If it's too easy, they're not paying attention. And if it's too hard, they won't really try.
Right.
The video games are so seductive because it's just at their level of skill to get them. And when they succeed, oh, the next level is there.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
The next level is there.
Yeah.
And I think it should be that for lifestyle changes as well.
Brilliant. Final question. What is the meaning of life?
I'm not equipped to answer that. I'm just learning about it.
You have life in your hands often. Yeah. You're the one who knows more than the rest of us.
I know. That's a complicated question. For me, the meaning of life is trying to have the greatest diversity of experiences in the short time I have on the planet. So my brain says to me, thank you for filling me up with all of that variety. That's good news and bad news.
Thank you so much. Brilliant.
Pleasure.
Thank you. And the book, Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon, is out now. And can people follow you? Are you on social media at all?
I'm on Instagram. I like to communicate too much.
Right.
I don't want to tell you where I'm shopping. I don't get that. But that's great if you do. I'm not diminishing anybody. Yeah. But I like to leave an occasional picture. And it's all thematically about brain surgery, neuroscience, and these kind of things.
What's your name on Instagram?
It's just at Dr. John Dial, DrJanDial.
Perfect.
And it's another artistic release for me. I enjoy that part.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you very much for including me.
Brilliant. I hope you thoroughly enjoyed that. Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon. I recommend a read of it because it's about your brain, which is what you are. I mean, I know you've got all your muscles and bones and blood and everything else and your sexual organs, but you're also a brain, and that's the bit. So it's fascinating. The bit which really got me, though, and it's right at the beginning of his book when he starts describing what the brain is like, what it's made out of and what it actually feels like. Because you just sort of assume it's a bit like a bicep or something, don't you? And then when he describes it, and it's like it's white and it's just got,
And you can put your finger all the way through it.
Yeah, I think in the book he describes it as, let me see if I can quickly find this. Bear with me on this. Here we go. I think it's around here somewhere. In reality, the texture of the brain is like no other flesh. It's more like flan or bread pudding. Push your finger against it and your finger will sink straight in. This is the bit that I can't... It's kind of quite gross. Take a thimble and you can scoop up easily a million or so brain cells. I mean, he's going in there, right, with suction equipment and scalpels and whatever else and cutting bits out, saving people's lives. And also the other bit, which really I just can't get my head around at all, is the fact that you're sometimes awake while someone's in your brain.
Yeah.
Like he's got machines going in his brain. But my thing that I like most about him, and I'm really impressed by him, I'm sort of, what's that ridiculous thing that people say, man crush? Because he's so vibrant and exciting and alive talking about it. But the idea that he's training his left hand,
yes,
so he can be ambidextrous because that makes him a better surgeon. That is what I love so much. It's like a proper sportsman or something. And he's got like the idea that he's also gonna, you must excuse the noise. We've got a bit of building work going on just beside us here. Mark's just shutting the door. But the idea that he's going to eat his food, left-handed, is incredible. I couldn't even... I mean, I'm all right right-handed with chopsticks. Could you do that left-handed?
I can barely do it right-handed, Tim. I'm an absolute...
Really? Yeah. I think I've been doing this brushing. Everyone laughs at me, but I do brush my teeth left-handed because I was told it just activates the brain. But it becomes second nature after a while, so it's probably ruins what you're supposed to be doing. But I think I'm going to do more stuff with the wrong hand and stuff just to try and get my brain working. Anyway, I thoroughly enjoyed it. As I said, I think it was one of the best podcasts we've ever done. I found him absolutely fascinating. This podcast is sponsored by Cooker, spelt Quooker, pronounced Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's amazing. I can see it.
That water is delicious.
I can see it right in front of me. Mark is drinking the brand new sparkling, chilled sparkling filtered water, which is absolutely delicious. It does chilled water. It does the 100, just chilled filtered water. It does 100 degree water straight from your kitchen tap to make your brews, your vegetables and stuff like that. Also just does your normal hot and cold water as well. And it just all comes in one tap. It's incredible. Thank you for them for sponsoring this podcast.
I heard some neighbours. I was walking down your street today to come to do the podcast, and I heard actually heard some neighbours talking about, do you know that guy at number so and so?
Yeah.
Is it Lovejoy Tim, something like that? Yeah. Do you know he's got one of those Quooker taps?
Did they say Quooker? Because you should have gone to them. It's actually pronounced Quooker. I know it's spelt Quooker, but it's pronounced Quooker. That's a great story, Mark, even though it's made up. We'd also like to thank our friends at Beer 52.
Yeah.
Who are today going to... Who are also our sponsors, really, in a way.
Yes.
Tell us about that, Mark?
Beer52.com. They are a craft ale / beer subscription delivery service, and what they do is they deliver new beers that you've never tried from around the world to your door, next day delivery as well.
Yeah.
And with on this podcast they've teamed up with us, and if you go to beer52.com/lovejoy, you could get yourself a free case of beer, and that's the beer, a snack, and this a magazine that we've appeared in. So it's a decent thing.
You do have to pay for postage and packaging.
Yes, you pay for £5.95 for postage and packaging, and you can unsubscribe at any time you like,
and if
you continue to and receive a monthly beer. Then this month's theme is Boston. So it's the Boston Beer Party, and what they've done is they've gone around Boston. And it must be an amazing job. I would love their job.
That would be your best job ever. Why don't you speak to Fraser? I know Fraser.
Because you're not allowed to travel.
Yeah.
you should do that.
It wouldn't be good for the podcast, but you should speak to him.
Well, I tell
you what, let's get him on the podcast soon, and then you can...
And then you're going to try and get me a job.
Well, let's get him drunk, and then...
And then get him to offer
and then
a
you
job.
Can, yeah, yeah, and then you can go, is there any chance that... next time you're going anywhere, I can come and do the beers for you.
And yeah, no,
but we do like this, and we're not just messing about here. But we do like it because we get to try these beers. And what Mark and I like to do is we play a little game with these. You also do it with your dad, don't you?
Because he likes these as well.
So we get one beer, and then we
just split it in half.
We split it in half and both taste it, because I like tasting the beer. This one though, I know I'm going to hate. So yeah, because Mark likes every beer, right? But
yeah,
I'm.
I see.
You speak into the mic. God, Jesus, you used to be a radio producer.
But then I found Beer 52.
Don't even speak into the mic. Yeah, no, I know. I'm just not going to like... Because Mark likes them all.
No, right, no, Tim, right. You maybe wouldn't go and order another pint of some of them, but what you have to appreciate is the skill and the stuff that goes into it. I love all
that. Yeah, you like all the different tastes, don't you? Yeah. Yeah, and I do like that. I do like the different tastes, but some of them I'm like, yeah, I'm not
Wait,
sure.
Because so you've got water, what... barley and hops, whatever.
All right, describe this one then. What does it say on the tin?
But I'm saying you've got sort of three basic key ingredients, and then how many different ones have we tried? Not one of them have been the same.
No, so never. What's this one?
This is Paradise. It's a New England IPA, and it's pineapple and mango.
Right, so you said pineapple mango, and I'm thinking I'm going to hate this. So I'm excited. I've got to say, actually, it smells nice. So let me give this a go.
It's a boiling hot day today we're recording, so it should be quite refreshing.
I like that.
I knew you would.
It's slightly going towards... No.
That's good, isn't it?
I actually like that.
It's quite strong. It's 5.5.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. But it's nice, isn't it?
If you fancy getting hold of some of these, go to Beer 52. That's beer52.com /lovejoy, and that's the way to do it. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know about anything. Brains, if you've got any problems you want us to talk about for the mailbag, any comments on anything that's been going on, please let us know. You can contact me on Twitter @Tim Lovejoy, and you can contact us on email dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. We will be back shortly. Well, we're doing one a week, aren't we? So we'll be back next Monday. For the time being, peace and love, Joy.
Bye.